Chapter 19. 6,000 spent the winter of 1897 in Dawson. Work on the creeks went on apace, while beyond the passes it was reported that 100,000 more were waiting for the spring. Late one brief afternoon, daylight, on the benches between French Hill and Skookum Hill, caught a wider vision of things. Beneath him lay the richest part of El Dorado Creek, while up and down Bonanza he could see 4 miles. It was a scene of a vast devastation. The hills, to their tops, had been shorn of trees, and their naked sides showed signs of goring and perforating that even the mantle of snow could not hide. Beneath him, in every direction were the cabins of men. But not many men were visible. A blanket of smoke filled the valleys, and turned the gray day to melancholy twilight. Smoke arose from 1,000 holes in the snow, where, deep down on bedrock, in the frozen muck and gravel, men crept and scratched and dug, and ever built more fires, to break the grip of the frost. Here and there, where new shafts were starting, these fires flamed redly. Figures of men crawled out of the holes, or disappeared into them, or, on raised platforms of hand-hewn timber, windlassed the thawed gravel to the surface, where it immediately froze. The wreckage of the spring washing appeared everywhere: piles of sluice boxes, sections of elevated flumes, huge water wheels, all the debris of an army of gold mad men. "It all's plain gophering," Daylight muttered aloud. He looked at the naked hills, and realized the enormous wastage of wood that had taken place. From this bird's eye view he realized the monstrous confusion of their excited workings. It was a gigantic inadequacy. Each worked for himself, and the result was chaos. In this richest of diggings it cost out by their feverish, unthinking methods another dollar was left hopelessly in the earth. Given another year, and most of the claims would be worked out, and the sum of the gold taken out would no more than equal what was left behind. Organization was what was needed, he decided, and his quick imagination sketched El Dorado Creek, from mouth to source, and from mountaintop to mountaintop, in the hands of one capable management. Even steam thawing, as yet untried, but bound to come, he saw would be a makeshift. What should be done was to hydraulic the valley sides and benches, and then, on the creek bottom, to use gold dredges such as he had heard described as operating in California. There was the very chance for another big killing. He had wondered just what was precisely the reason for the Guggenheimers and the big English concern sending in their high-salaried experts. That was their scheme. That was why they had approached him for the sale of worked-out claims and tailings. They were content to let the small mine owners gopher out what they could, for there would be millions in the leavings. And, gazing down on the smoky inferno of crude effort, Daylight outlined the new game he would play, a game in which the Guggenheimers and the rest would have to reckon with him. Cut along with the delight in the new conception came a weariness. He was tired of the long Arctic years, and he was curious about the outside, the great world, of which he had heard other men talk, and of which he was as ignorant as a child. There were games out there to play. It was a larger table, and there was no reason why he with his millions should not sit in and take a hand. So it was, that afternoon on Skookum Hill, that he resolved to play this last best Klondike hand and pull for the outside. It took time, however. He put trusted agents to work on the heels of great experts, and on the creeks, where they began to buy he likewise bought. Wherever they tried to corner a worked-out creek, they found him standing in the way, owning blocks of claims or artfully scattered claims that put all their plans to naught. "I play you all wide open to win, am I right?" he told them once, in a heated conference. Followed wars, truces, compromises, victories, and defeats. By 1898, 60,000 men were on the Klondike and all their fortunes, and affairs rocked back and forth, and were affected by the battles Daylight fought. And more the taste for the larger game merged in Daylight's mouth. Here he was already locked in grapples with the great Guggenheimers, and winning, fiercely winning. Possibly the severest struggle was waged on offer the veriest of moose pastures, whose low-grade dirt was valuable only because of its vastness. The ownership of a block of seven claims in the heart of it gave Daylight his grip, and they could not come to terms. The Guggenheimer experts concluded that it was too big for him to handle, and when they gave him an ultimatum to that effect, he accepted and bought them out. The plan was his own, but he sent down to the States for competent engineers to carry it out. In the Rinkabilly watershed, 80 miles away, he built his reservoir, and for 80 miles the huge wooden conduit carried the water across country to offer. Estimated at 3 millions, the reservoir and conduit cost near 4. Nor did he stop with this. Electric power plants were installed, and his workings were lighted as well as run by electricity. Other sourdoughs, who had struck it rich in excess of all their dreams, shook their heads gloomily, warned him that he would go broke, and declined to invest in so extravagant a venture. But Daylight smiled, and sold out the remainder of his town site holdings. He sold at the right time, at the height of the placer boom. When he prophesied to his old cronies, in the Moosehorn Saloon, that within 5 years town lots in Dawson could not be given away, while the cabins would be chopped up for firewood, he was laughed at roundly, and assured that the mother lode would be found ere that time. But he went ahead, when his need for lumber was finished, selling out his sawmills as well. Likewise, he began to get rid of his scattered holdings on the various creeks, and without thanks to anyone he finished his conduit, built his dredges, imported his machinery, and made the gold of offer immediately accessible. And he, who 5 years before had crossed over the divide from Indian River, and threaded the silent wilderness, his dogs packing Indian fashion, himself living Indian fashion on straight moose meat, now heard the hoarse whistles calling his hundreds of laborers to work, and watched them toil under the white glare of the arc lamps. But having done the thing, he was ready to depart. And when he let the word go out, the Guggenheimers vied with the English concerns, and with a new French company in bidding for offer and all its plant. The Guggenheimers bid highest, and the price they paid netted Daylight a clean million. It was current rumor that he was worth anywhere from 20 to 30 millions. But he alone knew just how he stood, and that, with his last claim sold and the table swept clean of his winnings, he had ridden his hunch to the tune of just a trifle over 11 millions. His departure was a thing that passed into the history of the Yukon along with his other deeds. All the Yukon was his guest, Dawson the seat of the festivity. On that one last night no man's dust save his own was good. Drinks were not to be purchased. Every saloon ran open, with extra relays of exhausted bartenders, and the drinks were given away. A man who refused this hospitality, and persisted in paying, found a dozen fights on his hands. The various Chichaquos rose up to defend the name of Daylight from such insult. And through it all, on moccasined feet, moved Daylight, hell-roaring burning Daylight, overspilling with good nature and camaraderie, howling his he-wolf howl and claiming the night as his, bending men's arms down on the bars, performing feats of strength, his bronzed face flushed with drink, his black eyes flashing, clad in overalls and blanket coat, his ear flaps dangling, and his gauntleted mittens swinging from the cord across the shoulders. But this time it was neither an ante nor a stake that he threw away, but a mere marker in the game that he who held so many markers would not miss. As a knight, it eclipsed anything that Dawson had ever seen. It was Daylight's desire to make it memorable, and his attempt was a success. A goodly portion of Dawson got drunk that night. The fall weather was on, and, though the freeze above the Yukon still delayed, the thermometer was down to 25 below zero and falling. Wherefore, it was necessary to organize gangs of life-savers, who patrolled the streets, to pick up drunken men from where they fell in the snow, and where an hour's sleep would be fatal. Daylight, whose whim it was to make them drunk by hundreds and by thousands, was the one who initiated this life-saving. He wanted Dawson to have its night, but, in his deeper processes never careless nor wanton, he saw to it that it was a night without accident. And, like his olden nights, his ukase went forth, that there should be no quarreling nor fighting, offenders to be dealt with by him personally. Nor did he have to deal with any. Hundreds of devoted followers saw to it that the evilly disposed were rolled in the snow and hustled off to bed. In the great world, where great captains of industry die, all wheels under their erstwhile management are stopped for a minute. But in the Klondike, such was its hilarious sorrow at the departure of its captain, that for 24 hours no wheels revolved. Even Great Offer, with its 1,000 men on the payroll, closed down. On the day after the night there were no men present or fit to go to work. Next morning, at break of day, Dawson said goodbye. The thousands that lined the bank wore mittens, and their ear flaps pulled down and tied. It was 30 below zero, the rim ice was thickening, and the Yukon carried a run of mush ice. From the deck of the Seattle, daylight waved and called his farewells. As the lines were cast off, and the steamer swung out into the current, those near him saw the moisture well up in daylight's eyes. In a way, it was to him departure from his native land, this grim Arctic region which was practically the only land he had known. He tore off his cap and waved it. "Goodbye, you all," he called. "Goodbye, you all." Part 2. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.